I fucking hate video.
Yeah,
aware.
I know, because I remember you talking about it. Sorry.
Good evening, everybody. I've been instructed to go to the lectern, even though I like walking around. That's so you can hear me. A very warm welcome to all of you for coming to the London School of Economics tonight. I'm Jonathan Roberts. I'm a professor at the Marshall Institute here at LSE. The Marshall Institute is a specialist institute which explores what we call private action for public benefit. That's charities, social enterprises, businesses, philanthropy, all coming together outside the government sector to try and make our world a better place. And we do that at the Marshall Institute through teaching, through research, and of course, convening fantastic events like this event tonight. It's my pleasure to chair tonight's event, Can Impact Entertain? Entertainment and storytelling, I think that's something I first really became cognitively aware of when I was at university and I studied Latin and Greek. And of course you can't escape the Odyssey and the Iliad, two of the most extraordinary poems, stories ever written. So entertaining, heroes, blood and thunder, gods, all this sort of thing. And so brilliant that even now we're going to have the next Hollywood blockbuster, which is Christopher Nolan and Matt Damon in The Odyssey. But of course, The Odyssey and The Iliad are not just stories. They were created for effectively a social purpose. It was about community learning, community cohesion, passing on the morals and ethics of those cultures, the Greek culture. So it's been in me for a long time how important storytelling is for our civilizations, for our societies. When we talk about our world, private action for public benefit, I think sometimes it's just a little bit too much focus, an understandable focus, on technical innovation, on frontline service delivery. And we forget that importance of storytelling, of hearts and minds, of changing discourses and changing beliefs about other people and other cultures. So that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. And we'll be trying to unpick two things, I think. First of all, how can entertainment create social impact? But also, secondly, this idea of a separate funding source, philanthropy, rather than commercial revenues and so on. When do we need philanthropy to come into this space? What can it do that other forms of financing can't do? So that's our agenda. And we're fortunate to have a really remarkable panel with us tonight to teach us about this area. Our keynote speaker is Alicia Fernandez Miranda. She's chair of IG Advisors and the US Today best-selling author of Someone's Got to Give. Fantastic novel, I recommend reading it. Alicia advises some of the world's biggest nonprofits, including the Gates Foundation, Ford Foundation, and UN Women, on social impact strategy. But much more important than that, Alicia is an alumna of LSE. It's always brilliant to welcome back one of our own, so welcome back, Alicia. With us too, we have Georgia Arnold. Welcome, Georgia. She's founder and chief executive of GA Agency and a pioneer in using mass media to create social change. Georgia founded the MTV Staying Alive Foundation and created the multiple award-winning MTV Sugar campaign. In 2023, she was recognized by UNAIDS for 25 years of leadership in HIV prevention work. And finally, we have Maria Bandy, welcome. Senior advisor for the Pop Culture Collaborative and Pillars Fund, previously Mario worked in layered representation, inclusion strategies and engagement for Disney Studios, working with some of the household names in film production, such as Marvel, Pixar, Lucasfilm and others. Her focus, objective was to advance representation on screen, and she was also executive director of Harness, using cultural strategy to center underrepresented voices in Hollywood. So it's going to be a fantastic discussion. Let me explain the structure. I'm first of all going to invite Alicia to talk for 15 minutes about her incredibly exciting new project around philanthropy and entertainment. And then Maria and Georgia will join us for a panel discussion. What I'm going to try and do is then leave 30 minutes at the end for all sorts of questions from the audience, which I'm really looking forward to. After the events, there will be a reception of drinks and nibbles outside. Please do all join us. You're warmly invited. So, just to mention, there should be no fire alarm tonight. If there is, we go up the stairs and we go to Lincoln's Inn Fields across the road from here. This event is also going to be audio recorded, and we hope you might be able to create a podcast from that. Okay, off we go. It's a very warm welcome to Alicia.
For 15 minutes about how LSE has changed in the 21 years since I was a graduate student here. One, this building did not exist. We did have air conditioning, and I was late to all of my classes, so it's really good that I was on time today. Dr., thank you so much for having me. It truly is an honor to be here, to see lots of friends in the audience, and to talk to you about a subject that is very near and dear to my heart, not just because it has become an area of, dare I say, professional obsession for the last year and a half and more, but also because I think the time could not be more critical to understand how we can harness the power of entertainment, and I'm talking big blockbuster, commercially viable entertainment to create better messages, more positive norms, and a better world, because guess what? Lots of people are already doing that to spread a lot of the messages that many of us don't want to see. So the time is now, and so I'm delighted to be here. I go this way, do I? We didn't have these fancy computer screens in the semester, and I have to do that before. Oh, I do this one. Oh, so excuse me, okay. This one? Frozen? Does anybody have any questions about the cost of LSE tuition? But actually, something's never changed. Okay. Thank you. Okay. So, I am the co-founder and chair of IG Advisors. We are a strategy consultancy in the social impact space, and we really sit at the center of where the public, private, and not-for-profit sectors operate. That special sweet spot, that overlap, is where I really like to work. Funny enough, my master's dissertation here at the LSE was about corporate philanthropy back at a time when almost no one was doing it, which meant there were very few primary sources I needed to use for my dissertation. Really the key priority, but it's funny actually that my life ended up going this direction of working in philanthropy, what I've been doing for the past 20 plus years. Started in corporate, IG works across the different sectors, but recently I have pivoted, to being actually a creative in some way myself. I had to put my deadline up there because that is like fresh news from last week. So, I decided in 2019, I wasn't sure if I wanted to be doing philanthropy at all. That's a topic for another lecture. And I went out to try unpaid internships at the dream jobs of my childhood. I worked on Broadway, I worked for an art dealer, worked for a dance and fitness company, and I ended up writing a book about it and discovered in that I really loved writing. And so that book is going to be a movie coming to a theater near you at some point in the not too distant future, or the very distant future, depending on how it goes. And I then decided that I really, really wanted to write about philanthropy and being a philanthropy advisor. And I'm not going off on too much of a tangent because this is important. I felt like as somebody who advises nonprofits, but also companies and high net worth individuals on their giving, there was always so much that I couldn't say, so many messages that I wanted to deliver, and I was unable to do that as a consultant and a service provider who got paid fees for giving advice. I couldn't always say the thing I wanted to say, and even if I did say it, it wasn't always going to be received in the way I wanted to receive. But I had a lot to say about philanthropy. I had a lot of thoughts after 20-some-odd years in the field. And so I decided to put that in the form of a novel, which is Someone's Gotta Give. It is available for sale outside of this lecture. If you'd like to pick up a copy, great summer read, and I'm told by the students the cheapest book that's been on sale for an LSE lecture, maybe because it's a paperback and a fiction read. But I found in the process of writing this to be true exactly what I've been working on with my research, which is that when you take a story, a compelling, entertaining, hopefully sometimes funny, maybe there's a love story, but an engaging story, and you use that to package a lot of the messages that you want to share, the impact will far exceed what you are able to do by lecturing is very important, but not just lecturing, and kind of outside of an academic context, and also how do you get people on board that are not necessarily already aligned with what you're thinking. So I've been doing some research with my amazing team, some of whom are here tonight. We have been working for the last 18 months. We were commissioned by the Gates Foundation and Luminate to really look at and understand how philanthropy could engage in entertainment media and what could it do if it was going to engage. What are the exact ways in which philanthropic capital, the world's most adaptable, flexible capital, some say, could be plugged into the process of creating commercial entertainment in ways that would help better social norms, change behavior, and achieve those kind of overarching programmatic and philanthropic goals that these entities are focused on achieving. How can we catalyze higher levels of investment by philanthropists into this field? So these are the topics that we've looked at in the research. I'm not going to go through all of them today, I promise, but I'm very happy to talk to you about any of them. What this research turned out to be, I don't know that we knew this from the very beginning, was a lot of helping philanthropy understand the entertainment industry and how the industry actually works. I had somebody very early on say to me, don't you just have an idea for a movie, write it, and then someone makes it. And I was like, no, it's a very, very complex process with a lot of different actors, and to be honest, it doesn't always make sense. So if philanthropy as a bigger field wants to engage in a meaningful way, there's a lot of understanding that has to be done. So tonight we are going to talk about not all of entertainment media, but this tiny little slice that's here in yellow. So entertainment media is a huge, vast, diverse ecosystem. It can include things including publishing, advertising, news media. I actually haven't briefed my other panelists on this, so maybe we will talk about some of the things and why, who knows. But for the purpose of the research and where we have been really looking, it's at kind of scripted content with a narrative. We're not really looking at documentaries in the case of this research that we've been doing, but we're focused on TV, films, and streaming platforms. Now, social media is in quite there, but really, social media comes into play within traditional entertainment media in a lot of different ways. So we're not really addressing the kind of influencer sphere, but where there is traditional narrative entertainment that's being shared on social media, where you actually have things being created for social media, that fits into the box. Maybe that box should be like transparent yellow or something like that. And we have not coined this term, but we have been using this term to talk about the kind of content that we want to be able to engage with. Now, I have two incredible experts on this panel with me who have been really focused on looking at the content itself. What does the content say? What messages are being shared? How is that going to be received? And what kind of impact will that then have on awareness, behavior, and social norms? For the purpose of this research, we are not looking at that at all, because I don't really know that it's philanthropy's role to be deciding what content should be shared, and I'm happy to take provocations on that. But I think that there are lots of other brilliant people who should be thinking about the type of content that's being shared. We have been focusing on how we fix the system more broadly to get more of this content, better content out there, and more diverse voices able to share it. So when we talk about nutritious content, we are existing at the middle of this Venn diagram. So we are looking at content as commercial, that is commercial in that it is making money and seen by a lot of people, because in a lot of ways in traditional media, you can use commerciality as a proxy for scale. If it's a really big hit, you know a lot of eyeballs are on it. We're looking at entertainment. Is it something that people actually want to watch and consume and spend time doing? And also, is it going to have an impact? And I think there is a word on there, intentionally impactful, and I think the intention is really, really important. I think the type of content we're looking at is not just content that so happens to kind of have a positive impact, but that wasn't really thought about from the beginning. We are looking at content that has been intentionally designed to have an impact while also being commercial and entertaining. No wrong way. So we've got a few case studies here, and one of them is Georgia, so we're gonna let her talk about that. But I think it's probably worth, just in terms of setting the landscape here, recognizing that it is very, very well documented and proven that entertainment media, scripted content in particular, can be extremely powerful, stimulate social learning, and create real-world offline impacts. So we've just got four examples here. I'm sure you're all familiar with Sesame Street. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the others. But these are just a few examples of how working together working at that kind of nexus of the Venn diagram, these are discussions have been able to create offline social change. A few examples that I would call out. I love the one from Cheers, that was a show that I loved to watch growing up. Cheers worked with the Harvard Alcohol Project for many years to develop the designated driver campaign. The campaign was super simple. It was just about getting the idea or the concept of a designated driver and the actual words designated driver into a mainstream sitcom that people were turning on once a week every evening to watch in their homes. And in 1990, they found that 89% of respondents in the U.S. were now familiar with this term that had never been heard before after it was partnered with Unshares and just plugged into the script. I think Sesame Street is another amazing example of being extremely intentional with what they do and also having tons of data and research to back up all of the different messages that they're putting out there for young children. This is one example that we just shared about their co-production in Afghanistan modeling gender equality. Boys and girls that tuned in were found to have nearly 30% higher than their peers, kind of better, more equitable attitudes around gender that were watching the show. And the parents who were watching the show were more likely to send their daughters to school. Telenovelas, very, very popular across Latin America, extremely, extremely great vehicles for shifting norms around everything from family planning to economic empowerment and agency. They are really heightened dramas, if you've ever watched one, and they are really excellent for being able to track change. I'm not going to talk about MTV Shipping because we're just going to talk about it, but an incredible example of a piece of content that was then proven to drive up HIV testing rates where it was being shown, and there's still Shipping Global still kind of going on. So, there's a lot of phenomenal research on how entertainment media can create an impact. But as I said, the focus really of what we've been doing is around the process. So this is a hyper simplified version of that process that that person said, that is just write a script and then make a movie and then it's all done. It features development, production, distribution, and marketing. And the really brief point I wanted to make here is that there are opportunities at every single stage of the journey for something not to get made, for content to be changed and revised, for things to fall off. And when you start looking at it at a systemic level, you start to see that there are all of these different systems challenges where something like philanthropy could be very well placed to play. So development, that's the creation process where you're conceiving the content, the script is written, you might be pulling a team together. You know, there's massively uneven funding across development in different parts of the world. Especially for producers, but even for writers, it's very, very difficult for people to actually be funded to do that, which means already at development, you're starting with a tiny little bottleneck of the people who can afford to actually take the time off to write a script that may never get made. And it really continues all the way through the process. Things like infrastructure come into play. So that is not just like, do you have the physical cameras and all of the technology that you need, but do you have enough laws to protect your intellectual property in the market where you are trying to make something that you want to make money off of eventually. We heard massively through the course of this research that distribution and marketing were the two really key areas where there were huge gaps that philanthropy could possibly fill with financing. So you've got very few aggregators. Your distributors are the people that are kind of getting the content out there to you. Theaters, streaming services, broadcast network, cruises, airlines, sometimes it's social media. And that distribution channels are controlled by a super clean number of people who are deciding pretty much everything that we're all seeing. And so there are great opportunities in there as well for philanthropy to kind of play a role. And then marketing, how you actually hear about the thing that you want to see and how an impact campaign runs. So this is a completely non-exhaustive, illustrative graphic kind of showing where philanthropy has played to date. Some areas you might be familiar about philanthropy engaging in this field are film festivals. So many film festivals are nonprofits, often funded by philanthropy. Film festivals are a really important way for smaller productions to get recognized in the scene and then get bought so they can be distributed. Impact campaigns, how many of you have heard of participant productions? Anybody? No longer here, yeah? So participant is kind of the best example of a company that was really focused on impact at the heart. Philanthropic funding was a huge part of them being able to create a piece of content and develop an impact campaign around it, which aimed to have a real world impact for actual activity that happened off the back of it. We talked about Sesame Workshop a little bit, research, data, and field building. Philanthropy has played a crucial role in kind of creating this evidence base that exists around who is able to kind of succeed in the entertainment that they're building. The MacArthur Foundation gave a $100 million grant to Sesame Workshop and the IRC to actually focus on not just getting content out to Syrian refugees that were displaced by the conflict in the Middle East, but also to build a base about how those kids were learning, what messages were they taking. Would not have happened without philanthropy. Talent development, education, that's like scholarships and fellowships for new writers. Content production, that's documentaries. You probably all be familiar with many documentaries are funded by philanthropy. And then things like content advisory is like a newer area. So Maria will talk a little bit about the type of advisory work she was doing at Disney, but actually thinking about where philanthropy could come in and support better content once it's already being created. And so we have taken all of these things and and so we've been working on this, I think we're up to like 124-page research piece if you'd like to read it, looking at all of these different trends, but really crucially thinking about what is next for philanthropy in terms of how it can engage. And so there are five things that I kind of want to leave you with at the very end of this. One is that philanthropy needs to play a holistic role. So not just funding one project, one piece of content, one part of the journey. It needs to be funding across the entire system because that is where the challenges are. There was a great example that everybody loves to cite, a movie called Origin by Ava DuVernay. A lot of different philanthropists got involved in funding that movie. It tanked. It did not make the money it wanted to. It didn't have the impact it wanted to. As a consequence, everyone was like, well, maybe philanthropy shouldn't do this anymore. But they're thinking too small. You never know what's going to hit when it comes to a piece of content. So you really need to be thinking big and holistically. Our research is looking at impact capital, so not just how philanthropy can support with grants, but also with debt and equity and lots of other types of investments to be able to get content made and possibly generate a return that makes it more sustainable. We think about three things, and that's the three G's, so time, how soon would it need to be paid back, what are the terms of the investment, and can they be more favorable for content that has better impact than not, and what's the type of investment that is being deployed, and where in the process is it coming. Cross-sector collaboration, this is about working with the private sector, but also working with governments, who are huge supporters of with tax incentives and education and training development programs and lots of other systems, and sometimes actually funding production in specific countries. So how could philanthropy be doing what it always does, work very well across sectors to mitigate risks and to work collaboratively to get solutions off the board. Rigor on impact, can't forget it. We still have to make the case, and it's super important that that doesn't get forgotten. There is so much data out there that exists about what you all want to watch on Netflix every day, and you will never see any of it because Netflix owns it all, and they never share it with anybody. So how could philanthropy come in and play a role on harnessing some of that data and using it for social good? And finally, innovation. There is a lot changing in this field. Every week, it seems we have to put a new piece into this report because something has changed. AI, big issue, an existential issue for the entertainment industry. There are ethical considerations that philanthropy could play a role in bringing. We've been presenting lots of ideas around different blended finance funds. So the last mile fund, which we put together, which is that last bit of marketing, distribution, and amplification, or a creative talent accelerator that's actually bringing people together. So that was my lecture. I went 2 minutes over time. I have really appreciated and valued the input of so many great people who have come as part of this project, both for involved with this project specifically in different ways, and I'm just going to be more honored to be on this panel. Thank you.
Anisha, thank you for that. That was so really interesting. To see you breaking down how philanthropy can have a role, what it can do, and also its weaknesses at this moment. So maybe we'll come back to that as we go along. But first of all, I'd like to talk to Mario and George about their work. So the first question I want to ask for George, first of all, is from your perspective, how is impact achieved through entertainment, and what are your
results
of that in your
life? Thank you very much. That was brilliant. Thanks, Alicia.
Whistle stop.
We're unexhausted listening to you. Hello, everyone. Shout out to the old MTV alumni over there. So, can impact entertain? Yes, absolutely. I have been very fortunate in my career. I walked into MTV as a temp for 2 days, and I never left for 30 years. See, the idea of CSR, those three words being attached together, did not exist. It turned out I came in as an assistant, I was really bad at it, and so someone gave me a charity budget to get involved with. And it didn't take much thinking to think, well, what do I do with this money rather than just write a check? And so I went to the talent team and said, if we make a documentary, on, you know, what would we do it on and who would we work with? And it was mid-90s, HIV and AIDS was rampant, AIDS was the biggest killer of young people globally. And so we made a documentary with George Michael hosting it. I don't know how many of you know who George Michael is. Let me tell you, I was his biggest fan. And we made this documentary, and one thing we decided to do immediately was MTV was growing around the world, and we decided that we had to create this content once cleared and pressed free. So we gave it away to any broadcaster who wanted it. And importantly, this documentary had the MTV brand attached to it. So broadcasters wanted to air it, and they could just take it for free. And so it grew from there, and it grew into something that we left behind the documentaries, although they still get done, they're done more in different creative ways. I'd highly recommend you to Johnny Jonte, which is MC Sugar Mashariki in Kenya, which has just come out, and it is a beautiful, powerful, scripted documentary. But one thing we started to do was work on the scripted content. So it was interesting what you said, Alicia, about intentional impact. So often I compare MTV Sugar, even though we started in 2009, well before sex education came onto Netflix. But I would say sex education wasn't intentional, and it's brilliant. But one thing about MTV Sugar is intentional. It is intentional about changing behaviors, changing attitudes, increasing knowledge about issues, and ultimately shifting norms. And all of those things are none of them happen overnight. We certainly have had to, over the years, prove the work works. Apologies, by the way, if I keep on saying we. I still talk as if I'm with MTV Sendai, which has been rebranded to Sugar Global and is doing brilliantly. But I still am very closely connected with them. But we started off focused on HIV. We then expanded to be about reproductive health, mental health, substance abuse, safe and legal abortion, LGBT in countries where we could. We work primarily across sub-Saharan Africa and also India. And the one thing that we did time and again was get this content evaluated. So does it entertain? Yes. And I can tell you why I know that, because time and again, Sugar, in all the countries it's ever been in, has won awards, most often voted by the audience, not by experts or industry people. So if the audience voting and it's like best entertainment, brilliant. But we also know it works because we know through RCTs, through longitudinal surveys, we know that young people are twice as likely to know their HIV status if they've been exposed to MTV sugar. Mm-hmm. And they're also, the Nigeria one, young women exposed to MTV sugar are 55% less likely to have an STI. But one thing I will say, and then I'll stop, is I will challenge Alicia on the idea that we have to keep on doing impact. We know it works. There is so much money. The philanthropists love investing in impact. Stop investing in impact. Invest in the content itself.
Very interesting.
Okay.
And now have my questions.
Yeah.
Oh. You just
undermined
the whole
realm. Yeah, I know. Sorry.
Can I ask the same question to Maria? How is it actually entertaining?
Yeah. So I have kind of two chapters to my journey over the last decade in this work. The first is really building an organization that worked in Hollywood with partners, both artists, writers, as well as the studios and production companies themselves. And so a lot of that work was quite targeted and direct in terms of kind of what Georgia life-saving work, by the way, the work that Georgia is talking about in terms of helping to develop content that has very specific and deliberate impact aims. The second part of my journey, though, I want to lean in there because I feel like it's a different like part of this work. And since we have folks that are already talking about the other that kind of intentional impact. Is when I sat at Disney. So Disney, for those of you who may not know, is the largest media company in Hollywood. It might be the largest media company in the world. It's a very, very large behemoth media company. And it owns kind of, you know, a whole host of other companies under it, right? So the film studios owns, as you mentioned, Lucas, Pixar, Walt Disney Animation. There's 8 studios total. We're also the largest producer of television in the world. I also still say we. and we're the largest licensee of consumer product in the world. So, you know, our consumer products and you've got our theme parks and all these things. So it's a massive media company that has made its billions, quite literally, through IP, intellectual property, right, and franchises. And what's important to know about that is the role that I took on when I was recruited to be vice president there was I was one of 2 teams that sat across all of our studios, and the chairman gave me a mandate that every single piece of content had to come through my desk, every script and every screening. And what that meant was we were, at my first year there, making about 250 films a year. That is reaching billions of people globally. So I say that to say that when we talk about impact, there is kind of project-specific impact, which is really important and meaningful. I think about conflict diamonds as an example, you know, like that, blood diamonds, right? But I also think getting into the systems themselves is crucial. Because where I sat within the system, I was able to build a process that was actually new to the company, that was both commercially successful. It added to their bottom line, and I have that confirmation, thankfully, my team, in all the round of layoffs that have happened, has still not been touched because of the fact that it is so clear that we add to the company's bottom line. So we add to the commercial value of the content, but we also really have an intentionality around impact. And I think that's important because there is, I think, different layers to impact. And so the area that I want to talk about a little bit is that storytelling is essentially human DNA. It's how we make meaning. It's how we understand ourselves, each other, and the world, right? If you look at cognitive and behavioral science, we are heavily over-indexed on emotion, heavily over-indexed on social networks and our environment to understand the world, not fact. That's actually just like our human nature. It's actually, we don't. Fact is important, but it's not what drives our decision-making. And so all of the stories we tell have an influence. They all have an impact. And when you don't have intentionality around that impact, it can often reinforce really negative beliefs. An example I will give, and this is a highly generalized example, but I want to give it as something that I think people often find surprising. One of the things that we have right now is a lot of dystopian storytelling. anybody watched like The Walking Dead or The Last of Us, right? Like, we know this guy, love it. Yeah, I love The Last of Us. Anyways, dystopian fiction, there is research that shows that it actually drives illiberal beliefs and undemocratic beliefs. And the reason why, and I'm making a big generalization here, it's not all dystopian fiction, it matters the story, it matters all the character, all that. But generally speaking, because it is promoting a world in which there is not enough, and you have to compete, and there's fear, right, and scarcity, what it does is it actually influences people to then adopt those behaviors and beliefs in their daily lives and reflect that in their political beliefs and behaviors, right? And so that's an example of where that's not an intentional choice anybody made. I mean, I'm sure there are people that intentionally drove that, but generally speaking, that's not like when you're a storyteller and you're telling a story, a dystopian story, you're not really thinking about it in that way. But there are real social implications of the fact that, like, how many stories have we seen of a positive future in the last decade? Very few. And what that does is that actually makes us, it makes it difficult for us to see a future in which there is good. And we tend to start to believe that, oh, it's inevitable, climate change is inevitable. And therefore, I'm not going to do anything about it. I'm going to take care of myself. I'm going to take care of my family. Does that make sense? And so this kind of importance around like having an analysis or a process system and thinking about impact in this way in terms of how is it that this type of storytelling actually reinforced underlying beliefs that actually lead to a breakdown in our social structures, right? Because this is what is leading to kind of the rise of different types of behaviors, right? Like the breakdown of trust between people, you know, the human connection that drives a democratic society, right? All of those things really, really matter in terms of the stories.
Really interesting. So can I move on from that to ask you, Mario, another question? And that is, from what you just said to me, I feel my response is, dissolve yourselves. So why not do more of it if you're a commercial company? So how can you tilt a commercial company towards being happy?
Yeah, so this is actually not true. And this is the thing that is really interesting about so much of like the things around that people will say around like common sense. And here's the thing that is so sad. So much of the business is driven by what people deem common sense. But if you tap it to data, it is not true. And this is one of the jobs I did while I was at Disney, was actually to start to like help people see that differently. So for example, you heard sex sells, right? Do you know that like the most successful and kind of most commercially successful content in the world is all family friendly? So actually family friendly content is what is much more commercially successful. If you think about it globally and you think about it in places like the US and the UK. I'll give you like an easy example of how you know that's true. Apple TV, right, which is a huge, Apple is a huge tech company, right? Apple TV for them is like their R&D department. They have a huge budget for Hollywood, but for them it's like a rounder. Apple TV has made a decision that they're only going to make family-friendly content. And why is that? Because they've done the market research and they know that actually that is where the market is. And if you can get to kids and you can build up from there, you really can build really strong brands, right? And that's like, obviously Disney is a perfect example of that and all the kind of franchises under Disney. And so dystopian fiction, sometimes we tend to think, oh, it was commercial and then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. But actually what we've done is we've put something out into the world. There's nothing else out there. This becomes the thing that's generating. Does that make sense? Like, so it's, we haven't really experimented. We haven't taken a risk with something else. Right, and so, and there's also, by the way, great examples of dystopian fiction that's quite interesting, but that is hopeful, that promotes empathy and connection and like all of these kinds of things, right? And that's really good storytelling. And so, ultimately, human beings want a happy ending. Dystopian fiction is not really about a happy ending, do you know what I mean? So, we have to kind of, we tend to think like the market, oh, this is just how it is, but we have to kind of, actually look at it clearly. Like another thing that people would say again is like a common sense thing is like, oh, people don't like diverse content, right? Like that time is done. I've heard this like a lot, right? But if you look at the studios, I mean, that is not the direction. And the reason why is because if you look at most of the successful movies that have come out in the last couple of years, they're all still led by diverse talents. And it's because audiences still want that. And so there's a narrative and then there's like the truth. And I think those are
we have been told across the board doesn't sell. And a place where Fully Up to Me feels very comfortable is earnest, really earnest content. So content that is really beating over the head of things that Fully Up to Me would like you to know. And we know that that content doesn't always, or rarely, very rarely, does that touch those emotional cords that Maria was just talking about and really get you to think about what it is that you're, how you're living your life, what you're doing, that are really connecting with you on a human and personal level. And I think that, which is not to say that there's not a vital role for documentary content, for very earnest content that exists, but when you are communicating with people in the private sector, entertainment, media industry, and you go and you're like, I want to talk to you about philanthropy, they're like, well, can't be too earnest because no one's ever going to want to watch that. But I think that it is tied into the first point around impact. And I actually agree with you, Georgia. If it was up to me, we wouldn't do impact. The impact studies are very much keeping alive a lot of impact measurement consulting firms that are measuring the impact. And they are important. It's not that you shouldn't measure the impact, but philanthropy likes to play where it feels comfortable. And so the reason I think rigor around impact is important is because if somebody comes and says, why should I give this fund, piece of content, slate of content, new studio you want to develop, $500 million, instead of using that to feed hungry children.
Right.
So there has to be that impact piece. But I think that the pendulum has swung very far to one side, whereas there's this idea that the only way that we really get the impact we want is if we like shove all our messages into this content.
Right.
As a result, you sometimes forget about the value of the story,
right,
and then you're in this vicious circle where no one's actually going to see what you're doing. So it's a very fine balance between being intentional, but also recognizing that you need to sort of let the story flow, that you need to let the creatives do their job, which is a hugely important piece of that,
yeah,
who should be telling the story, and that there needs to be a better way. Philanthropy in entertainment almost seems rebrand, I think, because you can't be walking into the room and have people thinking, oh, you're just gonna want me to force you these messages down someone's throat, where what philanthropy could really be doing is actually building a better system where you have brilliant creatives creating intentional content with impact, and that's able to move through the sausage machine and get seen by a wide number of people.
Really interesting. So I'm getting kind of two messages here. First is that this can be commercial, but we really need to educate the commercial companies about what is commercial. But secondly, there is this role for philanthropy, which implies not everything is commercial. So, Alicia, I was wondering if you could expand a bit more on, given what Mario said, why you do think there is this role for philanthropy in this space.
Well, I think philanthropic capital, or as we refer to it in our report, impact capital, has this incredible value of being able to de-risk things, risky things. If you are putting philanthropy into something, you're never going to see that money again and get it back. It is inherently a risky proposition. And philanthropy with impact is designed to be able to take those kinds of risks when it's working the way it should, being run by people who are running it in that way. So a lot, Hollywood is probably the most risk-averse place I've ever been. And I think that those, even though it's not necessarily to the same degree when you're looking at other centers of content production, be they Lagos or Mumbai or London or in Shanghai or wherever that might be, it is an industry that is really built on this fear and risk. Everybody's afraid of losing their jobs all the time. So this idea of taking chances on whatever the non-common sense thing might be feels terrifying to people. So if you can understand that you're operating in a system that's built on risk, and you can think about how can you use philanthropy or philanthropic capital or impact capital to mitigate that risk, how could you come in and say, do you know what? I know you're worried you're going to lose this money on this slate of productions, but actually, we're going to come in and put this amount towards the marketing budget. This is like a really simplistic example, but if you can go to the people who are making those decisions about whether or not something will get distributed and say, we've actually got all of these financial backers involved already, so you are going to be able to slice and dice that from your own budget, and we've also got a built-in impact campaign because they're going to be partnering with, you know, 400 different community centers around this particular area. They're all going to be screening the movie. They're going to be doing buyouts, whatever it might be. That automatically gives something a greater chance of succeeding. So this is part of why when we've been looking at the role of philanthropy, we've been looking at where can it intervene in the system, in the different stages of the journey, to let the content creators do their thing, to let the private sector play its important role or its role that it plays in terms of making money and getting content out there,
together to let governments build systems of build policies and build incentive systems and build support for the creative economies in their markets, and how can philanthropy work to de-risk that across the entire process? There's a really important role it has not traditionally played, but it could be playing, and that's the thing that really excites me.
Really interesting. So we're talking at least in part about a blended finance mechanism here, where you're still encouraging mainstream commercial finance, but you're allowing them in or taking away the risk from them.
Precisely. Yeah. So if you look at how films are financed, again, every film, every TV show, every piece of content is going to have a different financing story. But there are lots and lots of different pieces that essentially, if you think of it like a kind of vase of water that needs to fill up to the top, there's so many different pieces of finance that will come in to fill up that water. There is a place in that. Every different part of that stack, there's a place for a philanthropy to kind of come in and do that. But yes, I mean, I think it does involve blended finance, and that wouldn't always necessarily have to come from philanthropy. Some of the ideas that we're looking at are, well, philanthropy plays this piece of it. Maybe they're giving grant capital, but then that's going to unlock debt and equity that's coming in from a family office or a series of DAF providers or who else it might be, or somebody that's got, you know, when you're dealing particularly at that top tier of philanthropy, most of these individuals who are giving or institutions have many, many, many vehicles that they're giving from. So you might be taking a bit from here and there to be able to put the whole picture together.
So Georgia, can I ask for your perspectives on philanthropy? Because we were talking earlier, and I know you just came to a conference where you were extremely disappointed about the absence of funders and philanthropists. So what's your vision of philanthropy in this world?
So I hate describing myself as a fundraiser, but when you run an organization, even though I had the MTV brand attached, we were an independent charity. And so 85% of my job was fundraising, very little was production. I mean, it was my favorite part, but it's, you know, very little is that. I am a good fundraiser. I've raised millions of dollars from Gates, from USA, from PEPFAR, from the UK government, from the Nordics. What we saw at this conference is 98% organizations and 2% funders, and the only funder that was there was the Gates Foundation. And even they, because they're sunsetting in 2040, they've got three priorities now, and so they're more and more focused on those three priorities. It is a real struggle as an organization or someone wanting to create content for impact to find money. So I think from my perspective, I encourage all the philanthropists in the world to come and invest in this. You know, everyone, because there's very little money these days, everyone wants to invest in service delivery, right? I got 10 kids vaccinated. I protected those 10 kids from getting HPV. Amazing, by the way. But how do you know to get your daughter back or son vaccinated for HPV? You need to create the content around it. For these organizations, and you know, Sugar Global, which was staying alive, Girl Effect, which is funded by Nike predominantly, but their funding's going down. You've got the Discovery Foundation, which is no longer, which is now impacted and really struggling, I say that with respect. So all of these different organizations need to start thinking differently. The philanthropists are not sitting there with their purses open. We really need to think about, as an organization, how do I change what I'm doing? How do I bring my production costs down? And how do I work with others? So, you know, I've spent a week with organizations from across Latin America, from across Africa, and across India and Southeast Asia. And I would say none of them are being audacious enough. They really need to think differently. So I can give you a couple of examples. There is a fund called Audacious. If you get a Sugar Global going to Audacious and saying, we've got this brilliant idea, we want to go into 5 countries and we're going to create content that's going to change these 3 issues in the right direction over 5 years, Audacious are not going to fund it. The Sugar Globals of this world need to partner with other organizations. They need to look at coming together to reach different demographics with different styles of content and working across different issues. They need to be much more ambitious. But also, content like Sugar. Now, when you think about the cost of Sugar, it's nothing like the cost of a Disney or a Netflix production, but it's still expensive. And they need to start thinking differently. So I'm not saying lose the quality. I'm saying think about how you ethically bring AI into it. It's a really touchy subject for any creative in the room because it does mean that people's jobs are going to shift. But you need to think about AI because AI can help you develop storylines quicker. It doesn't take away writers' workshops, and it doesn't take away cultural integrity. But you can use AI to do that. You can look at things like vertical dramas. You know, you can. I don't know how many of you know vertical dramas, but they're 20 episodes, 1 minute of length each. They're clickbait. They're amazing. My boss is my secret sperm donor. Is my current favorite. Sorry. But if you can use something like a vertical drama to reach young people across Nigeria and get that storyline on WhatsApps and get it spread around, that is going to cost you $50,000 maximum,
yeah,
compared to a long form scripted TV series, which is going to cost you $3 million.
Yeah.
Right, so I think yes, please, to the philanthropists, but the organisations themselves, the content creators, need to think smarter today and differently.
It's really, really interesting. Thank you. So I'm going to ask one more question, and then I'm going to open it to all of you. So please start thinking about those really insightful questions you have asked. My final question, something I'm always slightly concerned about in this field of climate action, is who has power? So I wanted to raise that in this particular area, and there are two things which worry me. The first is who actually is in control of these big studios, what kind of people are they, what big experience do they have? And secondly, our answer when those studios are not doing the job is philanthropy. And then we have the same set of questions. So what I just want to ask is, who actually gets to decide about what stories are told? So can I ask you, Georgia, first, and then we'll move around the whole panel for that?
I think I'll tell you a personal story on this one. There is a moment that changed me, which was 3 years ago, I think, in Montreal at the AIDS conference, and I went to a panel on decolonizing global health. And it was at 8 in the morning, not a good time. It was 7 in the morning, but it's not a great time. The room was 3 times the size of this, and it was packed to the rafters. And it also overran by 90 minutes, which these conferences never overrun. And the panel was too long, there were 10 people on it, and it was really interesting. But there were two things that moved me. One were the people standing up to ask questions. And there was cues, there were two microphones, and there were cues of women predominantly from the continent of Africa. And what they were all saying was, we face the burden of all the problems in the world. We are the most impacted, we get the least support, we have the smallest voice in all of this. Why do people like us never run the organizations that everyone on this panel are from? And I sat there in the back of the room feeling really uncomfortable. I'd run into saying life for 25 years. And I was like, okay, it's, I need to really take this in and think about it. And I came out of there, and there was a man that I was meeting, an American man, who does not know the impact he had on my life. And he still runs a medium to large sized global NGO. And he said, look, a little pinky. I said, well, you were in that session. I was like, what did you think? He went, don't worry about it. They weren't talking about us. Mm-hmm. And he made me fire myself. Because I realized that, yes, the philanthropists have the power. Yes, the Netflix, the Disney's, the Paramount Sky Dances have the power. But I also have the power. And although with MTV Staying Alive, we were really careful about making sure that our writers' room, our production team, our actors, the audience, everybody was from the countries where we were working in, I still had the power. And I went to my board and I fired myself and I told them that they needed to think really hard about who they replace me with. And so I think we have to recognize who holds the power, and we have to take our own responsibility for that and take the action that we need to take.
I don't want to be negative. So there's a couple of things I'll say. Obviously, there's a huge media consolidation underway. And you see that, I can speak most specifically in the US. I have heard rumors of people trying to privatize the BBC and the NHS, and everybody in this room should fight to make sure that the NHS and the BBC are not privatized. As an American, let me tell you. In terms of our kind of media landscape in the US, which is a global media because of just the scale of media that it has, there is really, really big efforts underway for media consolidation, and ownership of our media platforms is getting concentrated in a smaller and smaller number of families, to be honest, who all have kind of very vocal political views. And so I think it's a real concern. I do think it's a real concern. I also think that what is fascinating about this moment in time is that new media, which we can't really call new media anymore, but like emerging media, social media, AI, whatever you want to call it, has really disrupted traditional media in the sense that 20 years ago, everybody was watching the same thing. Now you don't have that. You have the ability to have like a completely different landscape in terms of what the diet that people get in terms of media. And with AI, and I share the same kind of ethical concerns that Georgia was alluding to, and yet we estimate that production costs can be cut by at least 30% with AI, which means that that is going to be a very big factor in who gets to make the kind of content that gets mass appeal. Because a large reason why really premium content was gatekept was because of production. And so there's a way in which that's going to change now. Distribution also, for folks who are following media consumption, YouTube has now surpassed every streaming platform as the place that people go for content, especially for kids' content. Parents, that's where they go for their content for their kids, right? It's scary because that's also where extremist groups recruit, including white supremacist groups recruit. But it is incredibly democratic in the sense that anybody can put stuff on YouTube, right? And so why I say that is that while we see this kind of media consolidation that is happening, and it is nefarious and it is concerning, they've made it very vocal and explicitly clear what their goals are, so it's not like a hidden agenda here, it's a very explicit agenda. At the same time, I think that what we have is a audience that has more power than it ever has had before in terms of its media diet and creators who can reach people in a way that they've never been able to before. And I think that is, as we have this inflection point and this massive transition, right? And you see that more and more of people's viewing time is actually on digital media. It's not on television, it's not on film, right? You have a real opportunity to capture audience. And a couple weekends ago, so this is the first summer that has been a like box office like it was pre-COVID. It's the first summer we have big movie almost every weekend, right? And has anybody seen Obsession or Backrooms here? Okay, so both of those films are an example of something that is happening for the first time, which is YouTube creators who built massive platforms on YouTube have now created movies that have broken the box office. And so what you're seeing is that creator-led content is now succeeding the actual box office. And so there is a real power in the digital media space, and that is something, while the algorithm is in somewhat compromised, it is still a space for freedom in a way that we probably haven't had in the media landscape for like 50 years, you know what I mean? And so while that window is still open, it's really important, I think, for people to really take advantage of that.
I think that one of the fundamental tenets that I live my life by is that the issue is not that there is not enough money. It is just not in the right places. At IG, our mantra is around fixing the flow. We have like a neon sign over here,
Keeps Afloat that is currently in storage somewhere, but will be up in an office at some point. Because this is what I fundamentally believe. There are plenty of people with plenty of money. And there are so many brilliant creators who have stories they want to tell, incredible stories that would have an impact and make the world look better. Every time I apply for a fellowship or a talent development program, there's like thousands and thousands and thousands of people that apply for each one. And the problem to me, there is a plumbing problem in terms of how you access that capital and you put it in the hands of the people that should have the power and where it needs to go. So that is what I have devoted my entire life to trying to figure out how to do, because I can go sit in the rooms with the funders sometimes and they will listen to me because I'm like, smile, and I'm disarming, and I worked at a bank for a while, and now I'm making a movie, like everybody wants to hang out. So I can do that, and I can speak their language, and I can sit with the philanthropist and I can speak their language, but I can only do that because I recognize that I should not be the one with the power. I can tell my own stories, I like doing that, but the whole point is to try to bring around some of these people who have the resources to create change and help them see that it's the best possible thing they could be doing with their lives, and then get those resources into the hands of where it actually should be. So shifting that power is personally very important to me, and it involves sometimes, I think, a lot of compromises and trade-offs. This is part of what my novel ended up being about, all of the things that you give up in the quest to try to shift power. But I really believe that there is a different and profitable way, a better system of creating content. I am not a super big fan of AI involved in the creative process, or most things, to be honest. I am scared by what I see, the content I see my 14-year-old twins consuming and their obsession with stuff that I don't think is that really, that stuff that you sat with a TV show for 10 years of your life and you, that helps shape how you look at the world. So all of those things are also in the back of my mind, but I feel that there is a profitable way to actually create a better system. And it's one of the big bets actually that we are putting forward. Could you have an entirely different studio model that is competing with these legacy studios that were built in the 20s? You know, I had to sign my contract with Warner Brothers in actual ink and get a notary to do it. Like, there was no other way that I could do it. I'm like, where are we? Like, do you want me to send a carrier pigeon with it to you? And there are new technologies that can be embraced and enhanced. There is a better way to do this, and there are people who are ready to do this. They are brilliant, smart, creative people, and all they need is the capital to do it. So that's my role in the system. How can we shift some of the power that's out there by bringing the resources from an expression that I heard a lot through this project is cocktail capital. So this idea that people want to be in the room with A-list celebrities. People want to be in the room with talent. People want the invite to the premiere at Cannes, and they are willing to invest in different projects to do that. How can we harness all of these things so everybody wins at the end and the money is moving and the power is shifting? If I didn't believe that that was possible, I would be getting out of bed every morning. So. Yeah.
Okay, question. We have a mic, so you could just hold on. If you could just say who you are and where you're from.
Thank you. My name is Prajakta. I lead philanthropic partnerships for an edtech NGO based out of New York City. So we are actually an NGO that creates educational content but for children. And my question is around impact measurement. So when the final product of your work changes from service delivery to changing social norms, how should the metrics of impact change? Because that's the struggle we've been facing, to persuade philanthropists to look at different metrics for this kind of work. So I'd love to hear from all of you on that.
Also, I don't speak in the language of these amazing, brilliant researchers who I still don't think should be funded anymore to do all this work. They are brilliant and amazing. They've done some amazing stuff, and if it wasn't for them, Sugar Global wouldn't be existing today, because it lives off the last, you know, you're only as good as your last evaluation. I think from what I see, and particularly from a lot of the work that I saw last week, I would say be just be varied. That's the word I'm looking for. So think about doing both qual and quant. I am not a fan of quant personally, because I think the most important thing to do is to get people into the room to talk. It's really hard to show norms change, particularly because norms change can take years and years. So what you have to be able to show to those funders is you need to be able to show those different things of behaviour, attitude, knowledge change, and the things that they believe will shift norms. You can't, I don't believe, in a media project that is going to be short to medium term, it's really hard to show a shift in norms, but you can definitely show the intention. And I was going to say one other thing, and it's totally gone from my mind. So,
Great answer.
Okay, good.
I mean, there's small things I can add to that, but no, I think that's very, very good answer. Yeah, great.
I would actually extend that critique to service delivery as well. That by no means all really important service delivery can be easily measured and attributed. So we need to encourage the public funders to have a range of evaluation techniques, I think. Yeah. Other questions? We'll go to the front and then we'll go to the back. That's probably not an ideal scenario. So.
Hi, I don't really need a microphone because I'm a theater person, but I'm a former theater producer, Broadway worker, turned finance bro, and I am currently in master's with Jonathan Roberts here. And so a lot of what we're talking about in our master's currently is how these three specific sectors of nonprofits, government, and market can work together. And I kind of see media and entertainment and culture as this tool that I feel like we haven't talked about enough, that can really create all of this advocacy and get those voices out. How do you have any other ideas for how media and entertainment can work with one of those sectors that hasn't quite been done before? For example, I think about, U.S., terrible example right now, government, but ways in which governments could work together and provide that funding, or, a little bit of how all four of those parties can work together that hasn't become popular or accepted yet.
I can give you an example of a small example of where I think it's worked well on a small scale and could really be expanded. So much of what you watch on Netflix right now is filmed in Ireland. Wednesday, filmed in Ireland. Ireland has one of the most favorable incentive schemes for entertainment media. It was set up by the Minister of Culture about 25 years ago. And when you go to meetings with producers in Ireland, they mention him by name. There's like a statue of him somewhere, because it was like this one guy who, I can't remember his name now, I'm really embarrassed, Michael something. But he went on to, he basically set up a tax incentive scheme. And his idea was, if we can incentivize productions to come to Ireland, film in Ireland, show Ireland in a beautiful light, and also build up our creative industries here, everybody is going to win. So they created Screen Ireland, which is this kind of quasi-national body to be able to do that. And Screen Ireland will, it's one of the best ones in terms of the systems that have been set up to incentivize entertainment production. They do the typical things that lots of these government bodies will do, which is they will contribute to production budgets for Irish productions or co-productions, which is why a lot of people want to film there. But they also do things like if you bring to the table a project with a female director and a female writer, you can get an extra 50,000 euro of investment into your project. You have to meet, it's called the cultural standards test, which is that you have to show Ireland in a light that is compelling, but it doesn't always have to be positive, because there's films that get the money that are talking about really dark parts of Irish history, and they get made as well. So that is a great, just a very simple way that a government has been able to kind of boost entertainment media production in their industry. Now imagine if you had a world where that kind of government system was being created, But you also were able to bring in philanthropy to say, okay, for every production that's going to agree, we're going to fund an impact producer on every single production that gets made. And that impact producer's single job on this production is going to be to think about the impact. Imagine if adolescents had had an impact producer, right? That had not only, adolescents had a huge unintentional impact. And imagine if they had been working with nonprofits around the world to then be able to mobilize and advocate around social media harms and disinformation at the same time. So maybe you have philanthropy come in that way. And then imagine that you have the private sector coming. They're already part of this, and they are further incentivized to create these productions, and you are working within the private sector teams. So I actually think entertainment media is a fantastic place where you can have all of these different actors achieving what they set out to achieve. Nobody is like skewing too much from their mission, but everybody is contributing in the best possible way. And so one of the things we're excited about is thinking about how do you build systems like that in countries where there are really nascent film production industries or TV production industries, where you are able to start from the ground up and build a model where you've got the government playing its role, philanthropy playing its role, the private sector playing its role, and you're creating a better system of content going all the way through.
I would point to kind of two areas of opportunity, and they're not necessarily like systems like Alicia is talking about. They're more kind of areas that are changing rapidly, and I think there needs to be a lot of intentional thought and strategy placed there. One is, and this is an area I'm working in a lot right now, one is that a lot of the people that work in traditional media that have the ability to greenlight, that have the ability to reach billions of people, are fundamentally good people, or want to be good people. Like, they see themselves as wanting to be good people, right? And that is important because they often, like, universally have no experience or access to philanthropy, to the civil society. They are in a silo. And if you want to talk, Hollywood specifically is one of the most siloed and insular industries on the planet, I'm sure. I think it's famously known for being a very closed kind of town, right? And so what that means is that there's actually a tremendous amount of impact that you can have if you actually educate these actors, and not actors, I mean, in front of the screen, I mean, all of them. Through Harness, the organization I founded, we did a lot of work with artists, but we also did a ton of work with like studio executives and writers. And it has a really big impact when you give them like a more sophisticated lens on impact, and help them understand that they have agency, and that if they shift the way that they're making decisions, it actually has a tremendous influence. So that is one area that absolutely needs to be unlocked, because there's a huge community of folks who want to do good, who see the problems that are happening. We're not talking about the owners, because that is a separate kind of category of person. But if you're talking about the people within the system, a lot of them, including the people at the very top of these billion-dollar systems, are often really want to do good, but just are not equipped, do not have the education, do not have the relationships and the resources to do so. And so I think that's really important. It's like an area to think about. I think the other area that I am fascinated by, worried about, all the things, is digital media. Digital media is going to be the future of media. I mean, this is not something that's new to probably anybody in this room. It is also like quite unregulated. There's not a lot of categorization. There's not a lot of infrastructure. I know the woman who runs the research team at YouTube, she said the amount of content that is uploaded to YouTube every minute, no one is able, including YouTube themselves, to categorize. So nobody knows how much content is on YouTube and what is being said on YouTube, including YouTube itself. And you can think about all the kind of social implications of that, right? And there's a lot of work that needs to be done around policy. Like, for example, before Twitter X, you know, was destroyed, there was an incredible team that really thought about like hate speech and like policies around how do we keep this to be like a free market of ideas, but it's a respectable, like appropriate market of ideas. Right now that is obviously like gone out the window, but that is still an area of policy that is actually incredibly important, because we have these huge digital commons with all of this content that is coming out, and there is very little regulation right now on that. And that's actually very worrisome because of the kind of issues that can happen. And so I would say there's a lot of work that I think needs to be done there, that is a relationship between government, business, creatives, kind of like coming together to figure out what that actually looks like.
Thank you. Should we please So let's take question there, yes, please, and then we'll make our way to the back.
Hi, thank you. I'm a master's student here at LSE. My question is, how do you choose which social issues to tackle or which social norms or beliefs to advocate for, especially when the audience is at global level or non-UK or US countries, without or avoid imposing cultural or different cultural social norms or being paternalistic in a sense?
Excellent question. Yeah, students, hard.
Yeah, I know, right? I mean, I would say, unfortunately, a lot of the time at Staying Alive, our messaging for a new series was often encouraged by our funders. So, for example, if pharmaceutical wanted to do messaging around PrEP, they would come to us and say, can we give you some money for the new series of Sugar to do messaging around PrEP? Now, it was always good messages, so it was okay. So that's how we got a lot of our messaging, which helped us direct the series. But the other thing was we also took a lot of the messaging from the formative research that we did with our audience. So the formative research would always be based in the countries that we were working in. If we were setting a series in a township in the Eastern Cape in South Africa, that's where we would do our formative research. So we were talking to the young people whose stories we really wanted to reflect. So we knew that maybe we wanted to do a storyline around PrEP, we wanted to do a storyline around gender-based violence, but then we would have to go and speak to young people and hear their stories. So before we started filming in South Africa, we went and did a screening in the Eastern Cape in a rusty, dusty school, like up in the hills, and that I was with screened an episode of MTV Sugar Niger. And although we air each country series in all across the continent, it doesn't necessarily mean that it relates to everybody who's watching it from a different country. And so we screened it and we said, so if we come to South Africa, what sort of stories do you want us to tell? Mm-hmm. And there was a young girl who came from the back of the room, and she was wearing grade school uniforms, and her skirt was, you know, this is just like a global thing. Her skirt was rolled up, probably 3 levels too high for her parents to appreciate. Her cardigan was like slouching off. She was 16 years old, and I was so intimidated by her. And she walks up, and she says, "I know exactly what story you need to tell." And I was like, "Brilliant, tell us. What story should we tell?" And she said, "Well, it's easy. Someone's got to die." And I went, "Oh, okay. Well, how do they die?" And I thought, you know, this was the third series in, we'd never had anyone die at MTV Sugar before. And we'd sort of been quite conscious about not having someone die. We didn't want someone to die because of AIDS all the time. That wasn't the message we wanted to put across. And she said, "Well, you've just stood here and you've told me that sugar reflects our lives." She said, "Well, in our lives, someone always does." Mm. And I was so taken aback by it that I left that school, and I picked up the phone to the producer, and I said, "I've got a great storyline. Someone's got to die." And so we, you know, yes, it's driven by the funders. From our perspective, it certainly was. And also, I can tell you from many, many organizations, they are.
Yeah.
But it's also fundamentally, when you get down to it and you create the content, it's driven by the people who want to watch it, because that means that we're reflecting their lives on the TV, which means that they want to watch more of it and they're entertained by it. But also, you know, those messages come across quite clearly.
The only thing I would say is sitting within a system, which is quite a different thing, right? But I like what you asked about, like, the global piece. Is there are overarching problems globally that we're dealing with, climate being one, obviously. Another one being kind of the rise of like undemocratic kind of values and principles and these behaviors, right? And that leading to political violence. And so those kind of overarching things tend to be what we were focusing on. There were, every project had its own specific issues that we were dealing with. So like we would, you know, if it's a Marvel movie and it deals with this and this and that, like, okay, let's like introduce like opportunities for education or public health awareness or whatever that looks like within that specific project. But the overarching things were often tied to these overarching issues. that we need to kind of do narrative change around. And so that's kind of sitting where I sat. That was one of the privileges that we had to kind of look at. Yeah.
I just mentioned very briefly that one of the areas of interest for the same team at the Gates Foundation that has commissioned our research is funding film funds that have an impact lens to them, but that are really fundamentally about getting creators who have pieces of content to kind of move through a development system and get that content created. So Next Narrative Africa Fund is one of their grantees. I think they are amazing. They are run by a woman named Akuna Cook. And they got, I think, 2,000 applications for their fellowship program when it just launched recently. The impact areas were super broad. This is like the amazing thing when people used to talk about like their SDGs and they wear like their SDG pins like on their jackets. Like, you need all the SDGs. Like, you can't just pick two or three, but sure, people like to pick their ones. But all of these issues intersect, these cause areas intersect. So their impact areas are very broad, but they were really focusing on, can this be a great story and can it get made? And does it hit one of these impact areas? And then the funding was kind of pulled through a fund mechanism. So once a project, these individuals were supported to kind of work on the script and get their project through a completed script. And then they'll be able to pitch to execs. There's another pool of funding that will be able to invest in the productions of these. But fundamentally, the money has taken its hands away from what is getting made. And I think that that is how you try to not replicate some of these structures, by really letting the people who are good at telling stories tell the stories, whether it's that young girl in the back of the room or a writer whose heart is singing with whatever the thing is that they need to say. Those are the people that should be writing the stories. And I think what happens sometimes when you get too much influence from the top down, the story is not good. So it's not going to achieve your aims anyway. So that's a little bit of the education journey that we're going on with philanthropy, which is to say, like, I know you want to tell them exactly what to say, but you are not a writer. So let's think about, what does the writer want to say, and how can we get your point across without really kind of being too invested? And I think that it's really important to let the creatives lead, frankly, and be able to support a better system for them to do that.
Great. More questions? So should we take two at the back? We'll take them both together, if that's okay.
Hi, my name is Marion. I'm a researcher and journalist at the BBC, and I have a background in international development. Some of the really interesting things you were talking about on the panel was about the rise of Egypt and it being. The rise of digital media and that being the future. And I think that's one area that BBC and all the traditional broadcasters are really stepping into that space. And as you said, it is democratic in the sense that anybody can join and do that. Do you think that there's a risk that the impact can start to become negative, particularly because it's not a regulated space, as you mentioned, and you touched on hate speech, but also things like misinformation, which we saw during COVID, which was largely due to digital media space. But also, do you have any experience where perhaps you thought something was going to have a positive impact, but the impact was maybe negative? And how did you combat that situation?
Thank you. So can you remember that two-part question?
Yeah.
You can take your question too. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Stina. Not short for Christina, just Stina. And I'm a project manager at a non-profit organisation that focuses on providing medical care and global urban development. My question is, it's quite a long question, sorry. I saw a term online that described the current social climate as the most mentally obese generation yet. This is because of overconsumption of particularly short-form content such as TikTok and YouTube Shorts. Additionally, more and more scripted media is being intentionally written in an overly simplistic way to accommodate for the fact that oftentimes most viewers are scrolling on their phone whilst viewing the content. So the writers are aware that the viewers aren't able to pay attention to the content. So we have more access to knowledge and educational resources now than we ever did before. which is why the term mentally obese really resonated with me, because despite this vast access to information and resources, I do think that it's had a negative or regressive impact. So what do you think needs to change in order to promote tangible and also long-term change, as opposed to just short-lived feelings of inspiration and then everyone just goes back to their old ways? Thank you.
Thank you. So we've got three challenging questions. Maybe we could take two together. One is about the digital media space. And one is the liberty of democratization lesson, what that is. And the other aspect of it is, are we kind of dumbing down and simplifying, telling really unreal stories, etc. So who might have a couple of that?
I think, yeah, since I've been talking about it, I guess. I agree with both of you in terms of, like, your concerns or what you're posing as, like, potential concerns. You know, I think digital media is here to stay. I do think that the fragmentation of attention span and, like, media consumption is, like, really problematic. And I do think that one of the big things that has to happen here is regulation, and we don't have that. In Europe, you actually have the best regulations so far in the world in terms of looking at digital media. And obviously you all saw that recent law that just got passed around young people having access, which was quite controversial, right? At least in the circles I was in, there was like quite a controversial reaction to it. But I actually, for me, I agree with that kind of regulation, because young people, you know, their frontal lobes are not developed, and then they're consuming this content, and then it's actually changing the chemistry of their brains and all of these things, right? And so it can lead to like really harmful outcomes, as we know, we've heard anecdotally and we've seen in research. So I do think regulation is like a key component. And I think one of the things that, you know, modern society, and specifically, I come from California, like, you know, Silicon Valley has really pushed is growth without really thinking about the implications, the social implications of it. And what that has led to, at least in the US, is that government has not been able to keep up with the pace of technology. And so the kind of social implications of media are causing all of the kind of myriad of things, misinformation, disinformation, hate speech, all of this stuff, and the polarization in culture, the breakdown of social fabric, all of this is like very kind of known. But I also think that it's here to stay, right? It's not something that is going away. And when you look at research just to look at young people over the decades, what used to be the thing that would form their identity was their families and then their communities, and now it is media. And that has really shifted over the last like 20 years. And what that means is that content is actually more important now than it was 20 years ago. And so we have to think about regulation, but we also really have to think about putting good content out there. There's an incredible Media Matters article that does a mapping of the media landscape online. And it shows that somewhere, I'm gonna give you a broad number because I can't remember the exact stat, but somewhere to 60 to 70% of content online, at least in the US, is right-leaning. So when we are talking about the media landscape, generally speaking, and right-leaning, not in the sense of like, oh, conservative, I mean like really like a, you know, a pathway down to kind of undemocratic or illiberal kind of beliefs, right? And so that's a majority of content online. And so we really, really have to think about how is it that we start to ensure that the content itself, that we're getting as much positive content itself out there, and then also that there is real regulation around both like what is allowed to be on the platforms, and also like how are we engaging with those platforms and teaching like a media literacy and teaching media like media engagement practices.
I'll also be a bit facetious. I'll say Elvis and the Beatles, right? And Grange Hill. Like, all of these things, as we were growing up, I'm sorry, can I clarify, I was not around for Elvis and the Beatles. but apparently, you know, when Elvis was playing the
the parents would put their hands up in horror and say, the world is going to rack and ruin. This man is ruining our children. And I sort of feel, I do totally agree with what you're saying, but I sort of feel also with, we are always in that perpetual state of panic with the content that comes out. But I, that last bit you said, which I can't remember exactly what you said, but I think there's, so for me, I tended not to work on the global stage, even though I worked for MTV, I worked across Africa and India. And there's some projects going on in Kenya and Nigeria at the moment, which I'm involved with, which are called media hubs. And so media hubs are there to train people who may be content creators already. They're generally young people, but they don't have to be. And they train them first on gender norms. So it's a co-working space. It's amazing. You can get access to all the equipment that you want, production equipment, editing equipment. But in order to walk through the doors and have access to this for free, you have to have gone through a two-day gender norms course. And what that means is you get experienced writers and directors and producers coming in who've got scripts already written, and they start to think differently about their scripts. So they think differently about their Uber driver, who they had never really thought about. Side character was definitely a bloke because all Uber drivers are blokes, right? And then suddenly this course teaches them that maybe that Uber driver isn't. And so it's things like that where we have to think about how do we get in at the bottom? How do we can't stop consumption, right? But I did grow up on Grange Hill and I love Grange Hill and there were so many messages in Grange Hill. What about, you know, the Archers on the radio? That was set up, which is, you've never listened to the Archers, but it's a film that's, it's a radio scripted drama on Radio 4 that's all about farming. And the reason it was set up was to teach the British public about farming. And this was set up in the 50s, I think. So it's been around for a long time. And I think we have to continue to do it. I think we have to be thoughtful and purposeful in what we do. And I don't think we should throw up our hands in horror and say, AI is going to bring the world down. You know, there's really bad content out there. There is. There also always has been. It is really scary out there, and we could all sit here and, you know, say the sky is falling down, because it probably will do at some point. But I am an optimist, and I think if we can train from the ground up, and we can train at the grassroots level, then there's also hope out there.
So quick, please. Yes, and.
Do not make the mistake of believing that we are in this great democratic content revolution right now. Because guess what? Most of what is getting the massive amount of exposure online, there is money behind it from a small number of individuals. So Palantir is just funding their own movie studio. That's happening now. And it's got several layers and shell companies and a lot of different people are involved. But it is not at all the fact that I love this idea of a world where anybody can make content, and sure, you hear about like the person in their basement and it got really big, but the fact of the matter is that huge, huge companies, big, big money, very wealthy people are behind the majority of the content, even on digital platforms that is getting seen. So it's just to keep in mind, I think, that that is also a tool that we have in our arsenal with philanthropy to be able to combat some of that, because these are not just organic messages that are bubbling up. There's a reason 60 to 70% of that content is coming from right-leaning, because the right has been incredibly organized in funding content creators, influencers, podcasts, everybody, and unrestricted funding, by the way. Take it, do what you want. We're not going to do an impact study after it. We're just going to let you have it and see what happens. And they are now seeing the fruits of their labor exposed. So there is a system that exists underpinning this, and we are all actors in that system, and we have the opportunity to change that system. So take it and use it and stay aware, I think.
I enjoyed this so much. I think there are an awful lot of challenges in the world, and that comes across very strongly, but we're not dystopian. We can see the optimism, and we can see the fight we have to take part in, and that can be anything from clever funding mechanisms to really challenging the bad actors in the digital media space. So can I just thank all of you for brilliant questions. My apologies, I couldn't get to all of you, the ones who are has to be at the Marsh Institute without whom this event simply couldn't take place, so maybe that would be. Most of all, thank you to an amazing panel, Alicia, Maria, Georgia, it's been really extraordinary to hear your insights about this here, and look forward to continuing the conversation. Thank you.
About this like private good public benefit thing though, like
after today,
not so.
I think the skepticism is invited.
Seems like just creating chaos.
Much more effective.
Yeah, and this is a really unless it's a woman, so fascinating.